Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And you're in for a treat this week, because when it comes to curious artists, there's no one more apt and fitting of that description than U2 guitarist The Edge. Over the years, I've had the amazing good luck to photograph U2 and get to know those guys pretty well. And in that time, I've had the chance to witness some of the great moments that have been electrifying millions of U2 fans for decades. Well, my luck just got even better because I finally have the chance to ask The Edge about the sound, the story, and what I'm convinced must be the magic behind those moments. Like thousands of other musicians who have been worshiping at the altar of rock, punk rock, and new wave for years, I was curious to know so many things. What mysterious process creates some of the best riffs ever written? How much of U2's success was luck, and how much was pure ambition? And after 40 years, how have they managed not to kill each other and remain one of the most long-lived and relevant bands around? One hint, it wasn't by being cool. The Edge answers all of that and throws in some great stories about their iconic Red Rocks show and how they lost a record deal with every major label in London in one night. He also shares his painful personal struggle to reduce his live show guitar arsenal from 16 to 14 guitars. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Edge.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
No, it's great. I'm really excited about it.
Well, it's an honor for me to have you here because I've liked you two from the beginning. I got boy when I was in high school, and I've been following your career the whole time. And we've worked together several times, mm-hmm. which has also been really fun for me. And I kind of wanted to start there because I had a really interesting experience. It was probably just like a normal Tuesday for you, but mm-hmm. it was at Wembley.
Right.
And it was a sound check. It was the middle of the day, and you came out first, as you often do. I think you start sound check earlier than everybody else.
If I can.
If you can, yeah. And, you know, I was sitting on the edge of the stage, and you came out and plugged in, and there was nobody in the stadium, and it was bright, like, new, you know, it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon or something. And you started playing the Streets Have No Name riff mm-hmm. to this empty stadium. And it was instantly like this hugely powerful sound. And, you know, to me, it was like, wow. I felt like watching that moment that the tone of and the soundscape that you create, it's as much a part of the song and a definer of the band as the lyrics or the chords are. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I just wondered if when you do those sound checks, if you ever catch yourself in the moment and are able to hear sort of that power or that feeling.
A couple of times on the 360 tour, I really made a point of sort of stopping and just literally just taking it all in. Particularly, we played a show in Dublin and the stadium there, and Croke Park. It's like a very historic place. And I just made myself, in the middle of the show actually, just kind of stop, just look around at 80,000 people going completely bananas and just going, this is kind of a pinnacle experience in my life. I probably will never surpass this moment, but it's a pinnacle experience in anybody's life. This is kind of amazing. To be here doing what you love to do, and there's 80,000 people who are absolutely with you, supporting everything you do and have done, in love with your work, and cheering and jumping up and down. It's like, wow, I better not miss this. I better take it in. So to the point about the sound, you know, and what the prep that goes before the show,
yeah,
trying to wrestle with the sound that I have in my head that I'm trying to get out of the speakers and through the PA, there's an awful lot of, I would say, effort that goes in, which demands so much focus to make it right for me that I sometimes get a little too obsessive about it, and I do sometimes think that I don't fully appreciate how some of those guitar riffs are sort of really important within the U2 canon and within the kind of the sound of the band. I'm much more the guy who's like looking at what's wrong rather than the guy who's reveling in what's right. Like, that's, Dallas will tell you, my guitar tech.
Right.
Particularly on the first tour he did with us, the Joshua Tree tour, I would come in, on average, probably every second show and spend an hour working on that one sound, literally for probably about 3 weeks. And he kept trying to figure out what I was listening for. And I couldn't really explain it to him, but I knew when it was sounding right. And it was driving me crazy because it wasn't right. And I knew from the studio the exact tone I wanted, and I couldn't get it. So I was in there every day working with Joe, different microphones, trying different, making the other speaker, you know, setting up the guitars differently. We went through all sorts of permutations to, and we finally got to what I was happy with. And but it at times it's a sort of obsessive thing,
right,
where I just know when it's not there.
And you, I'm sure you're aware that there's a space in which you're the only one living in that space of that tone needing to be a certain way. It's working for probably everybody else, including
yeah,
the other guys in your
I
band,
know,
right?
I know. And they're looking at me like, oh my God, here he goes again. Huh? And it's, but the thing about it is I can't really relax. I can't enjoy playing. I can't feel good about what I'm doing if the sound isn't there for me. And if I mean, you make any number of analogies. I'm sure it's like a tennis player whose racket's just not feeling right. You know, you can't relax. You can't do what you do. For me, it's about the sound. I guess for any musician, it's that moment where it's just an inspiring thing to do. And for me, if the sound's there, I get inspired and I do my best work. If it's not there, I'm just going to be struggling, and it's not going to be fun.
And does it not sound like the song to you if the tone is even slightly off?
It's actually more a case of that's all I'm thinking about. It's just bothering me, and I end up doing my best to get over it and really kind of think in terms of, you know, this audience in front of us and the song I'm playing. But if the sound's not right, it's like walking with a limp for me. It's just not, it's not the same.
Do you ever envy, like, the guitar player with just two or three guitars on stage?
I do. I do envy him. And I also think to myself quite often, I'm really going to get this together. I'm going to reduce the number of guitars. And I go through this process and I'll, like, work really hard figuring out, okay, I can cross that one off. And then I'll realize, oh, no, I can't because that's in a different tuning. And then that one can definitely go. And then, no, I can't. Because that's the one that does. So I end up, after hours of work, I'll get it down from 16 to 14 guitars per show.
Well, plus you're a one-guitar band, so
yeah,
you're responsible for the entire sound. I mean, that's the thing that I've always found amazing, is how much sound can be created out of your band with only bass, drums, and guitar. And obviously there's some keyboard patches and things that, but, you know, when I was preparing for this, I went back and I listened to a lot of stuff and I watched a lot of things, and I'm amazed at how often the space is actually fooling me into thinking there's more complex things going on.
Yeah.
Do you remember figuring that out? Like, do you remember having an epiphany about space versus, you know, sonic, filling the sound with all these...
Minimalism was very much part of the movement that we grew up in. And literally, it was, why play three strings when two strings will do? So it was there from the beginning. But when we started to go into the larger venues, we realized that because the sound can get so confused and so messed up because of reverberations, and you're better off keeping it as simple as possible in a bigger venue. So almost our sound started to get even more stripped down the bigger the venues got. And exactly that, you know, one note out in, you know, reverberating through stadium means something different in that size venue. It's like playing in a cathedral, one single note, it'll fill the whole room. So if you try to play too fast or too many things, it just gets to be a jumble. So that, I would say, we grew up and our arrangements became more and more stripped down as the band started to play bigger venues.
And did that work its way into your songwriting as well?
Sometimes unconsciously, but then laterally, I think we now think in terms of how a song will perform on stage in front of an audience, because it's hard. You know, we've so many songs from the past that we love to play. It's difficult for a new song to find a place in the set. So we tend these days to give preference to the songs that we feel will compete and will possibly be end up in the show. Songs that we just know will never get there. It's not that we don't regard them, but we give them a lot less importance in the album making process. As a band, we grew up on a stage. You know, we're not a studio band, we're a live band that goes into the studio to make albums. And that instinct for the music that's going to connect is with us because of so many shows early on where it was about survival. You know, if you had songs that did connect, you were going to get a good reaction. But you learned pretty fast, you know, the stuff to avoid and what wasn't going to work, and that was like out of the set instantly. So we honed like the live set over many months early on, and that sort of informed our album recordings. From the first album, Boy, that was basically our live set, pretty much played in the studio.
But it's funny to hear you say that you're essentially a live band, because you're, you know, the textures you create and the riffs you write and just the layering of sound that goes on, it's also very, I mean, people could argue that the studio is a great instrument for you.
You're right. We've used the studio for many years as a kind of songwriting tool and a place where, you know, a sonic experiment can lead you to an idea that you never would have got to sitting with an acoustic guitar and a piano, because we're creatures of habit. So you pick up a guitar, you tend to play the same chords, go to a piano, the same. When you're in that playful place where you're experimenting, you're trying ideas, and you really don't, you're not judging anything, you're just excited by what you can do, you sometimes hit on something which is just, you would never have got to otherwise. And that's to me the most creative we ever get as a band, are those moments when everyone's going on pure instinct. There's no kind of roadmap for this particular way of writing or this particular compositional style. You're just really running with something on a very guttural, instinctive level. And where that will bring you is often much more potent and interesting than any conventional approach. I think of the song Bad. Brian had was playing around with our sequencer, and he just got this new keyboard, the DX7, and he just prepared a little sequence, and we were listening to it, and I saw Adam start to go for the bass, and Larry was heading for the drum kit, so I just picked up the guitar. We just started playing over this little sequence that Brian had created. And Bono came in the room and just started singing. And that song, we worked on it afterwards, but basically the guts of that song was totally improvised over this little beginning. And
oh, that little high-end keyboard thing, yeah.
And it was, for us, we'd never really worked off a keyboard part in that way before. But if for all of us, for Adam and Larry and myself, it gave us a kind of counterpoint to bounce off, where it freed me up in a way to play something that was really quite transparent musically and quite simple musically. And then it became all about simple chord changes. And chord changes, if you were on acoustic guitar, you know, here's our song, and you're playing like these very simple chords, it would be so ordinary. You would never get inspired by it. But in this context, a change of chord was a hugely dramatic thing. And it enabled Bono, I think, to go vocally in some very interesting places. And what's also fun about Bad in retrospect for me is that when we created the song, we liked it, but we didn't really reckon it. We didn't see what it was. So it actually appears on Unforgettable Fire, side two, not exactly buried, but it's not really in the shop window, so to speak.
Right, right. No, it's not. It shows up on the second
side.
Yeah,
and that was very indicative of how we felt about the song at the time. But the tune, when we started playing it live, we realized this kind of gravitas, this intensity that it had. And again, you know, so much of that came in a rush, in an instant. It was not labored over days and days of like trying different ideas. It was not written in that sense that a lot of our songs are written. It was more improvised.
Right.
And that is something that I wouldn't know how to write that. I wouldn't know how to sit down and go on piano, okay, this is how it is. It had to happen in some ways with everyone playing at the same time in the room.
I almost get the sense with you guys that you have to rip everything apart and start over each time. Like, to find a song in a magical way like that and to find an improvisation that turns into something, you can't recreate that formula, right?
We try, and what we will do, particularly, I think, working with Eno, who's a master of directing inspiration. That's one of his big things. I'm sure you're aware of his oblique strategies. He called them tarot cards, but they're basically ways to take a session from being in a kind of safe, orderly, predictable place and knock it instantly into a kind of beautiful chaos. So they are cards which suggest a change of strategy within the studio. So he'd shuffle the deck and he might take one out and it might say, everybody swap instruments. Or, you know, whatever song you're playing, play it at halftime. Or something quite dramatically different, but playful, you know. But what that really spoke to was Eno's understanding that the inspiration is often about being out of your comfort zone or trying something different, risking failure, as it were, and getting out of that very conscious place that we all are in most of the time, because the subconscious part of the brain is way more creative. And it's certainly true for me. I can say that often I will find a solution to a really complicated musical problem subconsciously, and it'll suddenly just arrive in a way that I hadn't really known I was working on or thinking about it. But somewhere in my subconscious, that problem is being resolved, and suddenly the solution arrives. And I don't know where it's come from. So that's, for us, that became a thing that we would try and do and find ways to unlock the creativity in the other members of the band and things you would do. And so we tell all our studio engineers the same thing when they come in, the juniors. We say, look, when you're in the studio, when you imagine that there's no point in putting the machine into record, those are the times you probably ought to be poised ready to record. And then the times when you're absolutely certain that you ought to be recording, they're probably not worth recording. Because what would often happen in a U2 session, it's happened dozens of times, we'd be there to cut the backing track for a song. And then someone idly will start playing something else. And then we'll all kind of slowly tune in and start playing along. And then this is, again, an improvised piece, but it's kind of alive and it's happening in real time. And most studio engineers who aren't used to us won't bother recording that, because they'll know, well, we're supposed to be doing the backdrop.
Right.
In fact, often those things turn out to be the best thing. It's just a feature of a U2 session that's confounding. And it's confounding for us as well. But it's really hard to know what's going to spark and what's going to kick off an important recording versus one that where it's a lot of effort, but probably not much to show for it.
It's funny. It's like I see this dichotomy between you being someone who's obsessive about tone and the exact right sound and everything, and yet some of your greatest successes come from complete accidental improvisation. And those two have to meet and work together.
And then what's confounding about it is you still can't dial it up. You know, that sort of creative inspiration is you're waiting around for it off. And you might not, you go in the studio, you might have a kind of ordinary day, and then you might, you know, 2 days later just get five or six really crucial things that happen. So it is confounding. And maybe it ought to be, you know. I've talked to a lot of musicians and producers over the years, and Quincy Jones talks about it as God walking through the room, you know, that you get a session where everything is perfect, and yet it's just lacking that spirit, that spark. And other times, for whatever reason, you know, you just walk in and you just, everyone is on. Something also to do sometimes with simple things like the sound of the room.
Right, right.
Often we seem to have a problem really doing our best work in the expensive studios when everything's like perfect. We seem to do our best work in places that are kind of thrown together, not sort of professional standard. I think about instruments a little bit like that, you know, custom guitars where everything is technically perfect and you pick it up and it's like, this is the best feeling performing instrument I've ever had. It's amazing. You go and try and write a song with it or, you know, record with it, and it's just, there's nothing there. Whereas you pick up some funky old, beaten up old Telecaster or Strat, and there's songs in there, and it's inspiration, and you just find yourself just playing parts that you know are going to go somewhere. And I don't know. It's hard to explain, but I think it was Charles Bukowski once said that nothing worth a shit was ever written in peace and quiet. And I think that rock and roll is a little bit like that. It's like it needs to have a little grit to make it work properly.
Have you developed ways around when the muse doesn't show up? Like, or are you somebody that sort of has to, or are you a band that sort of has to wait for that? Or are there times when you just have to sit down and slog it out until something happens?
Because it's so unreliable, the muse, you sort of have to be there, and you're in the studio, you're hoping on any given day that it's going to come together. And I mean, these days I would work a lot on my own creating beginnings, you know, songs that are unfinished, compositions that could become songs. And so we always have those to fall back on.
How do you present those?
You know, I'll just demo something at home using drum machines often, or sometimes I get loops of Larry playing and use those. And I'll even record vocals.
Oh, you will?
Rarely lyrics, mostly just a sort of placeholder of vocal melody. And, you know, so I'll bring those to the band, and if it's something that everyone's excited about, we'll have a go at it and see where it takes us. And when the band start playing, it's always so different. It's never sounds the way I imagine it will sound. And the decisions that Adam and Larry will make are never the ones I expect them to make.
Right.
And what Bono takes, if he takes anything I've done vocally, it's, you know, it's always a surprise. And sometimes it's slightly frustrating. Sometimes you're going, but you're playing it wrong, or you're not doing... But then when you step back later, you realize, wow, it's so much better. Even in our own work, we try to avoid ever repeating any formula that from the past. Like, I would never sit down and try and write a version of a song that we've already written. I know not only would it not work for me, but it would not work for the others, and they would dismiss it instantly. So we're always trying to find something that we've never heard before or never done before. And then things can happen very fast. That's what's fun about being in U2. You know, a song can, like the song One, It was just a couple of chord sequences that I was trying to solve a musical problem for another song and played these chord sequences to the others. And Danny, our producer, Danny Lamwell, said, hey, Edge, maybe try putting those together. See what happens if you play one into the other. I was in the control room just playing these chords on acoustic guitar, and everyone just went, that's really good, okay. So we went in the recording room, and just that song just came together so fast. And that was so exciting, because we knew as the song was kind of emerging from this session that it had a real power. It was kind of obvious within 16 bars of everyone starting to play together. Like, this is something really powerful and special.
You talk about that, and I wonder if when that thing strikes, if it's the same as when you were kids, like that same feeling in the room, or does that go away?
I think that's the moment we live for.
It is.
It is still the moment we live for, is that moment where we know whatever's going on in the room is the shit, and it's going off. And it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, Boy, the Streets Have No Name, but something is happening that's potent. And I think we learned to recognize it early on. There's such rare moments, and there's such... there are moments, as I say, that we live for. I kind of remember them all, you know. I remember those moments of Genesis. We, as a band, sort of caught the bug, as it were, playing live as 15-year-olds, where we actually got to play in front of an audience of our classmates in school. And that was a visceral moment of, like, you know, playing big chords and Larry, you know, playing the drums loud in a big hall. And that was incredible. That was such an adrenaline rush. In terms of composing songs, I would say it took us a little while to really tune into that. I do remember the first time myself and Adam really started improvising together was a couple of songs on the first album. One called An Cath Dubh, which is the Irish for Black Cat, and Into the Heart. It was just the two of us in rehearsal. And Adam was just playing simple chords, and I started playing along. And just responding to each other, you know, we were literally... every time Adam would make a change, I'd find a guitar change to fit that. And luckily we were recording, so we captured most of the good stuff. And that was a kind of a moment of realizing that, you know, playing in real time together in that setting could be a really effective way of getting to really interesting and unusual stuff, because the random quality there, I had no idea where Adam was going to go. He didn't know what I was doing or about to do. So it's this sort of response, real-time response to one another. Again, it's throwing you out of your comfort zone, because you really have no clue where things are going to go. But that responsiveness of trying to make sense of it all in real time unlocks a different part of the creativity. I think because we came out of punk rock, where the whole thing was, you don't need to be a muso, you know, that anybody can write a song, anyone can form a band. We ran with that, you know, and none of us really are like major students in that sense of the form. We all kind of did it our way, figured it out how to do it our way, and then put that all together. And that's why our band is like no other band, is because we've all pretty much figured it out from scratch. And keeping it simple, which is, you know, one of the sonic qualities of the band, is also one of the necessities of the band.
Did you know you were being original, or did you feel like you hit on something new?
Punk rock gave us a couple of things. It gave us permission to go for it without necessarily being seasoned players and, you know, real virtuoso musicians. This is the era of self-taught musicians, of ideas, you know, simple songs played fast that last 3 minutes with as few chords as possible. And so that was huge for us, and it gave us, as I say, permission to be a band. But it also instilled in us a sense of the need to be original and the need to avoid the cliches of the past. And so from the very beginning, as a guitar player, I was consciously looking for alternative ways to use the instrument that did not involve any of the techniques that had been popular during the sort of the mid-70s rock era. So we never bent notes.
Right.
We use vibrato seldom, but we did occasionally. We tried to avoid big crash chords. If we could play half chords or melodic guitar parts, we did. And then when the Echo became affordable, which was 1979, the end of 1979, I think I bought the first Memory Man Echo for a three-piece band who, you know, were trying to sound different. It gave me this incredible ability suddenly to create textures and atmospheres that wouldn't have been possible before. So it was really like a floodgate of possibilities for me and for the band. I can't express how important that moment was in our band's career, because it was like a level of dimension and a new palette of color sonically suddenly becoming available. And from everything being sort of monochrome, black and white, suddenly you've got all these other tones and textures and colors to play with. And it was very much in keeping with, I think, the punk ethos of be original, be different, don't do what everyone else has done before you. And it kind of forced us into this new channel, this new place in terms of songwriting and composing.
You know, I'm curious about the idea of wanting to make a record and how far away that seemed. But there must have been, I mean, I get the sense that you guys, you sat down and you schemed and you plotted a little bit. How did that come about, that to find a label or to find a manager to make that first record?
The first step along the way was we entered this competition in Limerick in 1978. Which we ultimately won, and the sort of first prize was
like a battle of the bands.
Yeah, it was a battle of the bands. We were definitely the youngest band, but we won. And what we got from that was £500, which is a fortune for us in those days, and the right to make a single for CBS Ireland.
Give me an example of £500 in terms of your father's salary.
That would probably have been like a quarter of my dad's salary.
For the year?
Yeah.
So that's quite amazing.
Yeah. And then we were like, okay, that's it. We
want to make it. So you used all $500 to make three songs.
Well, actually, we did a bunch of things. We did a photo session. We got to make a poster, which was really important. We hadn't actually ever had a YouTube poster up until that point. Got to buy some clothes, that, you know, because we were literally, you know, we were still wearing the stuff our mothers had bought us, you know, up to that point, pretty much. But it gave us the thirst to get to the next level, which was an album deal. And so we persuaded our manager, Paul McGuinness, that this was an important thing. He tried to persuade us against it. And in frustration, Bono went to London with Ali, took the ferry over with our demo tapes, and got to speak to a bunch of the UK music papers, NME and Record Mirror and Melody Maker. And off the back of that visit, we were on the cover of Record Mirror and Big Peace and Sounds. And suddenly, U2 were on the map in the UK. suddenly, you know, on the radar. So off the back of that, we said, okay, this is it. We want to get an album deal. And Paul was like, we can't, we really ought not to. But if you really want to, I'll organize some shows, like maybe 5 or 6 small shows, showcase gigs in London. And, you know, if we work really hard getting demo tapes to the record labels, maybe they'll come to the shows and we'll get you an album deal from that. So we had to go borrow money from all of our friends and family. We got enough together to just get us there. So we got to London. We did a couple of very famous gigs. We did the Hope and Anchor, which is a very famous gig. I mean, the Hope and Anchor was, you know, smaller than this room.
No kidding.
Tiny. But unfortunately, we were quite sporadic live in those days. We weren't a particularly reliable live act. And we just didn't impress. It just didn't happen for us. The London crowds were too laid back, and we probably weren't at our most confident. So we saw literally every single London record company, and every single one of them passed over us and said no, they didn't want to do the deal.
You're kidding.
So in one sort of fell swoop, we basically ruled out getting a deal with every single label in the UK. So we got back to Dublin, and it was a terribly devastating kind of realization. It's like, that was our shot, and we didn't make it.
Did it feel like that could be the end?
It was like right there. A lot of labels were almost going to do the deal. It was CBS were almost going to do the deal, A&M. They all were almost going to do it. And then finally, they just, one by one, just went down. So we got back to Dublin, totally dejected. And I can't remember how it came about. I'm sure it was our manager, Paul McGuinness. He suggested that we play a homecoming gig in Dublin. And we were thinking, you know, one of the bars we played before, and we're like, okay, that's maybe not that exciting. And he said, no, I've been talking to my friend Dave Kavanagh, and we think you should play this boxing stadium, which is like a 2,000-seater. And we're like, wow. And he said, look, we'll get in touch with all our friends, we'll advertise, we'll do the big U2 homecoming show, and we'll make it big, and, you know, we'll at least get something out of this London trip. So we agreed, and, you know, I don't know how, of the 2,000 seats, we probably sold, you know, 900 or something. It was respectable. It was certainly not sold out, but it was respectable. So we did the show, and as it happens, it was one of our best shows. Really an amazing night. And, you know, all our crowd were down the front, and it was the big celebration of U2 coming back to Dublin. What we didn't know was that the A&R man from Island Records had missed us in London. He'd been away. So he, without telling us, flew to Dublin, went straight from the airport to the gig.
It's like waiting for Guffman or something.
It's crazy. He saw this show, flipped out, and we were in the dressing room after the show, still kind of feeling a little sick to our stomach about the London trip. And he walked in, and he said, I want to sign you guys. I want to sign you right now. Best show I've seen in months. And basically from utter, like, on the floor, knocked out cold, disaster, we, within a week, turned it around and got our deal with Island Records.
That's an amazing story, because it just shows also how you can think at any given moment. You can take yourself out of the game.
Yeah.
Right? And so many bands probably did.
Yeah. And that also, that instinct to up the ante, you know, to double down, you know, to not kind of allow the headwind to kind of knock you off your game. Again, lots of moments where one member of the band would have gone, well, that's it, you know, I'm going back to college, or I'm going to get a regular job. But none of us did. We all, you know, and our manager also, we just it was almost like instinctively knew whether it was going to be easy or hard. We were, this was where we belonged. Something about the thing that the four of us could do together was going to get us there in the end.
Can you talk a little bit about, or give me sort of some insight on what a band meeting would have been like around right before the time where you get to go and tour America and what your ambitions were at that time? And
Adam, I know early on, was sort of saying crazy stuff like, well, we'll be as big as the Beatles. And we would look at him like, yeah, pal, like, that's going to happen. But we desperately wanted to make a record and get out of Ireland. We were so like the hick kids from this little, you know, parochial backwater Dublin city.
Is that how you saw yourselves?
Absolutely. And that's really how we were seen. All our emphasis was on the music. None of it was on the clothes, the sort of the context within the scene, because we weren't in that scene. Dublin was very much its own thing. But I think it started to dawn on us all after the first album came out and the tour started to really get momentum and the shows started to get great reviews, that, wow, we're not bad. You know, like, this could go somewhere. Like, we really keep pushing, you know, it's a good little unit here, you know, it's like, it's working. So
it took you by surprise a little bit.
A little bit, yeah, I have to say. And I suppose the thing I don't quite understand is why we never took the foot off the gas and went, well, we've done it now. That's great. You know, we've made our albums, we're out of Dublin, we've sort of proved our point here. But it seemed like there was always something to aim for, something to go for next. And nothing we ever did was kind of enough, in a way. There was always something else to prove, always some other hill to climb. And I guess that's just how all of us are built. It's just this hunger to strive, to get higher, further. And that's maybe, above anything else, the reason for our success, is that insatiable desire to push it further and to go further. And but none of us had a clue early on. None of us had any inkling that it would become as successful as it did.
Did it seem important to you to actually succeed in America, even when you were that young? Or was it more like, this is bigger than we ever imagined, so let's just enjoy it?
We really liked the idea of doing well in America. And I think at that point we didn't suffer from the sort of cultural disdain that seemed to permeate a lot of the UK punk bands. They arrived in New York, played a couple of shows, insulted a lot of radio DJs and other people in, you know, the music business, and went home and thought they had kind of been to America, you know,
right,
done it.
Right.
And we, like, arrived, we were hungry to see all the different parts of the country. And I guess without that attitude, we just started to win people over. And then it just got really exciting, because we thought, wow, our music, which is definitely Irish, but influenced by the UK and this sort of European, started to actually connect in America in a way. And that then became the new focus.
Was there an example of something there that really struck you as worlds colliding?
We had some great experiences early on where we would show up. In the case of one show in Boston, we were second on the bill to a band who at the time were a well kind of regarded up and coming Boston band called Baruga.
Okay.
So we went on at, like, you know, 7 o'clock, did our 40-minute set, and the place went nuts. We thought, wow, this is amazing. The Baruga audience are clearly like a very generous crowd. So we went back to the dressing room and we all wandered down later to see the headline act. Got down there and everyone had gone. And we realized that even though we were second on the bill, everyone had come to see U2. So it was such a surprise to us. We'd never played in Boston before. What we discovered was that the kind of the subculture was alive and well in the kind of college radio scene.
Right.
So we, without any knowledge, had been played a lot by the local college radio DJs, and our album Boy was like becoming a real big hit in Boston. So there were little moments like that where you suddenly, what's going on? This is weird, but great. And, you know, when we finally got to play Red Rocks, that was another one of those moments where it felt like a real watershed. Yeah. That's actually an amazing story because with everything about U2, we always doubled down with everything. Like, there was never any safety net with us. It was like, so we'd made a little money on the tour. So what are we going to do? Let's invest it in a tour, like a live concert film. So we got in touch with some producers from Channel 4 in the UK, and I think they put some money together to match ours, and they committed to broadcasting it. So we get to Red Rocks, and it's an outdoor venue, as you know, but it's up in the mountains, quite high up, and the weather has gone against us, and all these clouds are moving in, and it's starting to rain, and rain pretty badly. All the camera crews are sort of hiding under cover, and our promoter's saying, "I have to cancel the show. We'll put it on in 3 weeks' time or whatever." And we're like, "No, you don't understand. We have to perform. You know, we got this live film to shoot." And the promoter's on the phone going, no, this can't happen. People around here, they know if the weather's bad that the show's off. They won't show up. It's not going to happen. We have to cancel it. So there was this kind of tussle between us and the promoter for an hour or two. And about like 2 hours or 3 hours before we were due to go on, and a few people were starting to show up, the weather started to get a bit better. So the point of stopping raining, it was still like walking into a huge cloud, but we announced on radio, we're going ahead with the show. And so we ended up, although it was a sold out show, we ended up with maybe half the audience there. But we were determined. We went out and we did the show. It turned out to be one of the legendary U2 shows.
Yeah, well, what I remember about that film is that I think it cemented my understanding of the band as just determined to connect with an audience.
Yeah.
And determined to, like, win over every single person in the crowd. But it's funny hearing that story and knowing that you know, what the stakes were for you guys.
Yeah. Yeah, we would have been broke, and we were so immersed in the moment that we didn't really have time in those days to think too much about it. Everything was so spontaneous. Everything was, you know, last minute decisions to do this. None of it was planned. I mean, even the white flag that became such a big symbol of that tour was just something Bono grabbed out of the audience initially, and afterwards, well, that was kind of good. Maybe we should feed that into the show more often. And next thing, it's kind of, we actually started to make these, you know, flagpoles. And I mean, we got so much stick for that. But I think as a symbol, it really was potent. It summed up sort of our attitude at that time. And it was a little gauche, probably, a little OTT, but that's who we were. You know, we were that committed, we were that passionate about it. And the one thing we never suffered from, I suppose, was a debilitating sense of cool.
No.
We were willing to go out there and be as uncool as was required, as long as it felt right, as long as we believed it.
But I think what you found is that there's a larger audience out there that feels uncool and connected than wants to stand there like this.
Right, yeah.
Judge the show. And you were so young, too. When I think about, you track the timeline, you had massive success before you were, 22, 23 years old, right?
Yeah.
How do you cope with that? I mean, did you develop a method of sort of dealing with success at that young of an age, or?
I'm sure it took its toll at the time. I remember phases where all of us kind of lost the plot for a while. But the thing about our band is that we're a real band. We are four guys who are friends and really committed to each other.
When you say real band, what do you mean?
Well, I think there's a lot of bands that sort of come across as like, unified, street gangs. I mean, that's what a band really is, a kind of street gang that doesn't grow up. And within that, you assume there's loyalty, that there's a sort of fraternity, there's respect and regard and consideration. Then often you find out afterwards that, there's one guy making all the money and kind of the other dudes are guns for hire, or that there's this awful bad blood between band members and that it's just a show.
Yeah.
Not the case with our band. We've from day one, we've been friends. We've been there for each other in the good times and the bad times. So the pressures of success were big, but no matter how bent out of shape any of us got, the others were there to pick up the pieces at the right moment or, give us a shove in the right direction. And that is huge. And it's also the sort of ability to accept your bandmate as they are without judgment. So there's an acceptance there of a mutual acceptance, flaws and all. We're in this band together and no one's position is in jeopardy. In that sense, it's like once you're in, you're in. And as long as everyone tries their best, no one gives, no one cares about, whether somebody's winning or losing relative to somebody else, because it seems a lot of bands get to a certain phase of their life and it's like the inspiration dries up and
right. No
name's necessary. You see it like there's an arc, there's a sort of period, the purple period where everything, is like inspiring and then that seems to end. For us, we've never wanted to accept that. We're like, no, why, think about the great filmmakers, painters, composers, working, much later into their lives, successfully doing great stuff. And we're like, yeah, we're going to do that. We're not going to just accept that, we had a golden period and go into some sort of middle-aged retirement. No, we're now pushing hard to maintain the standard of our work. So that's a struggle for sure, and continues to be. And it's a real bugbear for us is that we don't want to get soft. We don't want to get complacent. We don't want to have a sort of distorted sense of entitlement that just because we're U2 that everyone should love our work. And to us, we sort of know if it's great, and so it means it's still a struggle. In other words,
I wonder if that's part of it, is that each time all four of you have to sort of still be excited about the possibility of making something new.
Yeah, we rely on each other. We really do. It's a cooperative in that sense. We all do something quite distinct from each other. And, no matter how the sort of creative roles break down, in the end, unless all of us are involved fully, it's never going to be a great U2 recording or performance or song. So that reliance combined with a genuine regard for one another, I think, is probably the secret of our longevity. That's why we're still here. We know deep down that we do our best work in the cooperative, which is called U2. And there's no real internal competition, you know. That's not to say, you know, there's a strict demarcation either. Like, you know, we just, wherever the best idea comes from in the room at any given moment, that's what we're going to take. So, you know, if I have a bass part idea, I'll offer it up. If Adam can, you know, wants to suggest something to Bono or Larry to me, I mean, it's, there's a lot of that within the band. And in fact, that's, I think, another secret of the success of our group, is that my guitar parts are a kind of critiqued by three other guys, Bono's melodies, lyrics, critiqued by three other guys, so that makes us all better than we would be otherwise.
What's amazing, because I've watched a little bit of that dynamic, what's amazing is that none of you seem to get hurt by it. None of you seem to take it too personally.
We've learned not to take it personally, but we're also acutely aware of the greater good that can come from it. And then, you know, what's better, to be proved right or that the collective wins? And we've all learned over the years, you know, what's better is that the collective wins.
Very socialist band.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, you know, whose idea it was. You know, like, hypothetically, if Bono hums a guitar part in my ear and I go, okay, that's a good one, I use it. It just makes me look great if it's a great guitar part. Similarly, if Adam, you know, uses a bass part that I suggested, no one knows it's my idea. It's just the great Adam Clayton.
Right.
So there's no downside in just going, okay, here I am. I've got some ideas, but has anyone got a better one? Because if they have, I want to use it.
It's quite amazing. And I think I would agree, it's the reason for a lot of the success is that you guys are truly a band. And I think you can hear that in the records.
Yeah, and reliance on each other.
Yeah. Well, God, it's great to talk to you. I could sit here for hours. But thank you for sharing this with me and taking the time.
It's been great. It's really fun.
Hey, folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actress, writer, and superhero Kristen Ritter.
I haven't been shy about what I wanted to do. I remember saying things like, I want to be a musician and an actress and a writer. And my friends would be like, are you crazy? Like, those are the three hardest things to do. And that just never computed for me. I'd never remember having a lot of fear.
In taking on the lead in Netflix hit series Jessica Jones, she got the role of her dreams and more than she bargained for. Kristen and I talk about her tough but formative adolescence, being at the forefront of a new TV format, and why you might want to buy a pack of Post-its the next time you're at the store. See you next time, off camera.